time that it's. It's been a while since we've been here together in the seminar room, right? More than a month. Sorry, it's been a while since we've been here together in the seminar room, so it's nice. Last week, we started studying the 39th chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra, often called the Gandavyuha Sutra, as if it were a separate text. And we introduced, we said a lot of background stuff, and we introduced just the first few pages of the sutra up to page 15 in this Cleary edition. I think Laura was telling me that she found a third edition that she's put a link on the website. So we have various options to read, but I'm using this one. If I give a page reference, it'll be to this one. So we read the opening pages, and it was a dizzying scene of bodhisattvas and all kinds of people who were there from all over the place, and splendor and magnificence and extravagance of every sort, attending the Buddha as he begins to speak in the moment just after his awakening. The next thing that happens is that the Buddha enters a concentration state called the coming forth of the lion. That's the name of the concentration state that the Buddha then enters at that moment. So a little footnote here about concentration states. Probably you all know that in early Buddhism, there was a standard progression of 8 concentration states, very specific with characteristics, each one, and meditators were to practice these 8 concentration states. And although in Zen we don't you know, talk about them or have a sense of progression, Zen is kind of well known for having no progress, just one thing, you know. Still, in the classical text, there is this progression of 8 concentration states that are presumably psychological states that we could course in if we were trying hard enough and we were better meditators than we actually are. However, in Mahayana sutras, you soon realize that when they talk about concentration states, they don't seem to mean anything like this at all. They don't seem to mean normal or even abnormal concentration or meditation states. They seem to mean cosmic or poetic imaginative realms that are almost beyond what a person could realistically or think about, you know, as far as something that you would produce through your meditation practice. In fact, in Mahayana sutras, they really don't seem to be talking about meditation practice at all. Mahayana sutras, I would say, it would be fair to say that Mahayana sutras pretty much leave meditation practice in the dust. They seem to be not really interested in it at all. And that's why it's so interesting for us that Dogen's idea of meditation also, he says very directly, this is not meditation. It has nothing to do with meditation. It leaves meditation in the dust. And the way that Dogen describes Zazen in his most many, many fascicles of Shobogenzo are Dogen's descriptions of what it is to practice Zazen. And when you read them, they do seem like, although they're not as lengthy and as extravagant, they do seem like they're very much in keeping with the soaring poetry of the Mahayana Sutras. And the genius of it all is that Dogen says that you don't need to read all these sutras or imagine all of this stuff. All you need to do is, and he gives us instructions, you know, sit down, put your hands like this, sit up straight, so on and so on. Just do that, and you will be in the middle of those Mahayana sutras automatically, whether you know it or not. That's pretty much what he's saying. Anyway, so that's my little footnote about concentration states. And here the Buddha enters into the state of concentration called the coming forth of the lion. And that's significant because the lion is associated with Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, who is almost always depicted riding on a lion. And this bodhisattva, I cannot think about Samantabhadra Bodhisattva without thinking about our great friend and teacher, Blanche Hartman, because Samantabhadra was her favorite bodhisattva. She was always had images of Samantabhadra around in her sewing room and other rooms, because she was a very active person, always doing stuff, Blanche. And Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva of doing stuff, a very active bodhisattva, active on behalf of sentient beings, not just doing a bunch of busy stuff, but doing stuff all the time to serve sentient beings. And Samantabhadra is the main bodhisattva, or one of the chief bodhisattvas referred to in the Gandavyuha Sutra, in this last part of the sutra, the 39th chapter. And the sutra ends with the 10 great vows of Samantabhadra. And Cleary never uses the word Samantabhadra. He, as always, he translates all the names, and he translates Samantabhadra as universally good. Capital U and capital G. That's the name of Samantabhadra. Universally good, meaning good action all over the place, all of the time. So, anyway, the Buddha enters this concentration called the lion's concentration. And this is such a powerful cosmic act that it gets the attention of all these other Buddhas in all these different realms and all throughout the cosmos. They realize that this very special thing has happened, that the Buddha has entered this concentration state. And so each one of them, from every direction, and the sutra, you can imagine, goes into each one of these directions: east, west, north, south, southeast, northeast, northwest, et cetera, above and below, and so on and on. From all these different directions, all these different Buddhas who are in those directions send bodhisattvas to the place where the Buddha is now sitting in this concentration. And they all come from whatever marvelous world they have been inhabiting, and every one of these worlds is described. And they come to this world, which we learn here is called the Saha world, which Cleary translates really beautifully as endurance, with a capital E. That's the world we live in. The realm we live in now is called endurance. Did you know that? That's the name. That's where we are. Yeah, that's where we are. We're in. Yeah. And there's plenty to endure, right? Isn't it true? I mean, I think, when you're young and happy-go-lucky, maybe you don't think about this, but at a certain point, it dawns on you that there's lots to endure in this world, and there's no escape from enduring it. And then when you live in dramatic political and social times like we live in now, then you really know that it's a world of endurance. And the reason why it's enduring, why this realm is the way it is, why it's so tough, it's tough for us. It's tough for our benefit, because it gives us not only the possibility of, but the necessity of awakening. We can't live in this realm without awakening, because it's too difficult. We have the incentive and the necessity to awaken. So in other words, this world is very tough, but it's not too tough. There are other worlds that are very too tough, way tougher than this, way tougher than this. And in those way tougher places, you can't practice. It's too hard. Here, it's hard enough that you have incentive to practice, but it's not too hard that practice is impossible. So this is the world of endurance, and they all come, all these bodhisattvas come to this world, and they all have special powers and tricks to create marvelous things that they can offer to the Buddha, so that each one does that, and it tells you what each one offers. After they make their offering, they sometimes, I forget now, they walk around the Buddha. This is the what you're supposed to do. You see a Buddha, you're supposed to walk around the Buddha respectfully with your right shoulder toward the Buddha, and then make an offering to the Buddha and sit down and listen and wait for the teaching. So that's what they all do. Another footnote here that is important, I think, and really interesting, is that Cleary makes the choice. He never uses the word bodhisattva, right? He translates the word bodhisattva. And he translates the word bodhisattva as enlightening being, which is a pretty decent literal translation, awakening being or enlightening being. And it's good. Cleverly good, because it emphasizes that unlike a Buddha who is enlightened already, a bodhisattva is not enlightened, a bodhisattva is enlightening, meaning in the process of enlightening. It's an active, right? It's an active situation, not one that's settled. The Buddha is settled. Bodhisattvas are actively ongoing. But it has a double meaning, because not only are they actively ongoing, but they are enlightening others. That is their process. They're in process, but the process that they're in is the process of enlightening others. So compassion and concern for others and for others' fundamental well-being is what characterizes bodhisattvas. So they are enlightening beings in this true, in this double sense. Because a bodhisattva can't be enlightened by themselves. They can only become enlightened when all other beings are enlightened. So a bodhisattva is very busy working all the time on behalf of beings. In many, many ways, and there are passages here that talk about all the different ways. And their work is always ongoing. So that's a good translation, enlightening being. That's a good translation for bodhisattva. Okay, back to the story. They're all there, and the Buddha's in this concentration. And so I'll read what happens, how it is. So all it looks like we lost our we lost our mic, yeah, amplification.
What's our page? Your page number?
I'm on page 21 in Cleary. After all the enlightening beings show up and are described, all those enlightening beings with their retinues were born of the practice and vows of the universally good enlightening being. That's Samantabhadra. They had the pure eye of knowledge to see all Buddhas face to face. They were endowed with the acute ears to hear the ocean of teachings of all Buddhas. They had reached the ultimate transcendent attainment of the masteries of all enlightening beings. From moment to moment, they issued manifestations of going to all Buddhas. They were in the range of pervading all worlds with one body. They had luminous bodies appearing in the circles of the congregations of all Buddhas. They were in the realm of showing the reflections of all worlds and one world contained in each other in a single atom. This is the interpenetration teaching we talked about last time. They had the power to guide and develop all people with appropriate timing. Timing is really important. You know, sometimes. Don't say it now. You got to wait for 10 years before you can say that to her. They had the power to guide and develop all people with appropriate timing. They were in the realm of the meeting clouds of teachings of all the Buddhas from every pore. They had attained the knowledge that all realms of beings are like illusions. They had realized that all Buddhas are like reflections. They knew that all existence, states of being and birth are like dreams. They had pure knowledge that all developments of actions are like images in a mirror. So this idea of the world as a dream, a mirror, an illusion is something that these bodhisattvas completely get. They were intensely aware that all becoming is like a mirage. They perceived that all words are like emanations. They had attained the illumination of the knowledge of the 10 powers of Buddha. They were fearless and mighty, able to roar the lion's roar. They had entered the inexhaustible ocean of analytic knowledge. They had attained knowledge of expressions and principles of the ocean of instruments and thoughts of all people. They coursed in the knowledge of the unobstructed space of the reality realm. They had attained unimpeded knowledge of all things. They had purified the spheres of super knowledges of all enlightening beings. They had the rigor to roust out all bands of demons. They stood firm in the power of knowledge of past, present, and future. They had attained unobstructed omniscience. They coursed in the space of independence. They were powerful in the space of the effortless stage of omniscience. They coursed in knowledge of the ungraspability of all existence. They had exposed the knowledge of the ocean of principles of all realms of reality. They had entered the door of non-discriminatory knowledge of all worlds. They demonstrated the mutual interpenetration of all worlds. They manifested incarnation in all realms of being. They knew the various forms of all worlds, subtle and gross, broad and narrow. They had attained knowledge of the interpenetration of minute objects and immense lands. They could reach all Buddhas in a single moment of thought. They had the body of knowledge of all Buddhas. They had attained unconfused knowledge of all regions. They could pervade the ocean of all locations in a single moment of thought by mystic metamorphosis. The whole Jada Grove, which is where this is all taking place, that's where the Buddha was, that's where the Bodhi tree is. This whole Jada Grove became filled with enlightening beings of such immeasurable attainments by the power of the Buddhas. So they're the expression of the power of the Buddhas. So the Jada Grove, as I say, is an historical place where the Buddha practiced and taught. And now it's filled with all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, amazing to behold. And all the Bodhisattvas look around and see this splendiferous scene. They're just delighted by it. However, remember that in the assembly are also not only Bodhisattvas, but all kinds of regular people, including arhats and practitioners of the Pali way of Buddhism, and leaders and rulers of kingdoms and so on and so on. All these people are there. They can't see any of this. These other people don't see any of this. So it's right there in front of them, as we've just read, but they don't see it. They can't see it. So if we can't see it, we shouldn't be surprised, because you know, we're kind of like them, right? In fact, could it be the case, actually, that right now, when I'm talking to you, appearing to be an ordinary person in a room on the planet Earth with all these chairs and people, that actually the room, in fact, is full of immense numbers of bodhisattvas on every atom of space, and all these splendiferous things, except we don't have the kind of eyes that can see them. Just like in this sutra, it says that there's a bunch of people there who don't see any of this. Why don't they see it? Well, it explains why they don't see it. This maybe explains why we don't see it. Why? And now on page 23, second paragraph from the bottom. Why? Because they were emancipated. So they were, you know, enlightened practitioners, but they were emancipated by the vehicle of the hearers. They had realized the path of the hearers, meaning the path of the people who had heard the early teachings and made use of them. They had realized the path of the hearers. They had fulfilled the sphere of practices of the hearers. They were fixed in the fruit of the hearers. They rested on the knowledge of the light of truth. They were fixed at the limit of reality. So they were no slouches. They were very impressive people. However, they were stuck at the limit of reality. They had gone to the state of eternal peace. They had entered nirvana. But they had no thought of great compassion and had no pity for the beings of the world. They had accomplished what they had to do for themselves. And that's why they couldn't see all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the splendiferous world that was right in front of them. They had gathered in the Jada Grove and were sitting there in front of, behind, sitting there in front of, behind, and to the left and right of the Buddha in his presence. Yet they did not see the miracles of the Buddha in the Jada Grove. Why? It is not possible for those who have not developed omniscient knowledge, have not accomplished omniscient knowledge, have not set out for omniscient knowledge, have not resolved on omniscient knowledge, have not undertaken omniscient knowledge, have not penetrated omniscient knowledge, have not purified omniscient knowledge to understand or become aware of or see or discover the miraculous manifestation of the concentration of the Buddha. Why? Because that is discernible only to the range of the vision of developed enlightening beings, not to the range of the vision of hearers. That's why they couldn't see. So we learn here that these wonderful bodhisattvas have two essential qualities. The first one is compassion, and the second one is omniscience. And these two necessarily go together, because the kind of compassion that bodhisattvas have is not the kind of compassion that we think of. We think of compassion. It's way, way more than that. And that's where the omniscience comes in. Omniscience is complete openness to everything, all of the time, without limitation. And the compassion of bodhisattvas is that kind of compassion. It's not compassion for certain people who seem to be suffering. It's a universal compassion without any obstructions. And then, so that it requires necessarily omniscience in this special sense. Not that you know every fact and every, you know, name of everything and all that, but that you are open, fully open to each and everything and experience and moment without exception. There's nothing that you reject. You are completely open. And then your eye of compassion opens and you see all of these celestial Buddhas and all of these beings to be saved. Next, the sutra gives us 10. And remember, like we said last time, whatever the sutra has, it's always 10 of them. Gives you 10 metaphors to explain this strange situation. This situation that some can see the splendid vision and other people can't see it. It gives you 10 metaphors. And I'm going to read for you the second of the 10 metaphors, because I think for me, it's very interesting and it makes a kind of interesting point. And now I'm reading on page 24, the second paragraph on that page. So this is the second of 10 metaphors to explain this situation, which has already been explained, but, you know, in this sutra, nothing is just left, you know, alone. You got to elaborate. So it gives you 10 metaphors. It takes a number of pages. Second metaphor. It was like the case of a person who has dozed off in the daytime in the midst of a large group of people, and while asleep, sees a celestial city with beautiful mansions appearing there in his dream, and sees the whole summit of the polar mountain with groves and gardens with innumerable nymphs all around, innumerable godlings living there, and various celestial flowers scattered about, and sees wish-fulfilling trees providing various celestial garments, jewel ornaments, and flower garlands, and sees musical trees producing all kinds of sweet celestial sounds. You didn't know that trees could make music, but yes. And many kinds of forms of pleasure and diversion, and hears the sweet sounds of the music and singing of the heavenly nymphs, and perceives himself as being there, seeing the adornment of the celestial arrays all over the place. The group of people who are there in the same place do not see this. They are not aware of it, do not observe it, because it is the vision of the man in his dream, not the vision of the group of people in the same place. In the same way, the enlightening beings and the world rulers on the verge of enlightenment, by virtue of the tremendous power of the Buddha, by the attainment of their own roots of goodness, and by their own undertaking of the vows for omniscience, by development of the quality of all Buddhas, by stabilization in the magnificent path of enlightening beings, by accomplishment of the outgrowths of the teachings of all aspects of omniscient knowledge, by fulfillment and purification of the higher aspiration of the acts of the universally good, capital U, capital G, enlightening being, by entering the spheres of knowledge of all the stages of enlightening beings, by mastery of all the states of concentration of enlightening beings, and by unhindered contemplation of all the spheres of knowledge of enlightening beings, saw the inconceivable power and mastery of the Buddha, understood and comprehended, whereas the great disciples, the best of the best, did not see or understand because they did not have the eye of the enlightening beings. Now, the thing that I find great about this metaphor is that it's sort of, even though it's a metaphor, but it's sort of like giving you the idea that what these bodhisattvas are seeing and everything that we're seeing in this sutra is basically a dream. It's a dream. The bodhisattvas are dreaming all of this. That the bodhisattva path of universal salvation is a dream, that the bodhisattvas are dreaming. But remember that just a minute ago, I read you a section where it says that the bodhisattvas understand that the world itself is a dream, right? Remember that it's all an illusion, a mirage. They look at this world and this room that we're sitting in, and they see that it also is a dream. So their dream is a dream next to a dream. It's a dream within a dream, or a dream that encloses a dream. So yes, this sutra is, by its own admission, an imaginary, dreamlike illusion. It is not real. However, it is a true illusion. An ordinary life, which is also an illusion, a dream, is no less true. But the dream of ordinary life includes the dream of ignorance, which brings along with it the dream of suffering and trouble. Whereas the bodhisattva's dream leads us out of suffering to compassion and complete openness, which I think is a better deal. That's what the bodhisattva dream is about. And don't you know somebody else who had a dream, right? To me, it's a very striking thing, right? Martin Luther King's, "I have a dream." And he says, this is a dream, right? He doesn't say, like, next year, maybe in 5 years, I have a 10-year program, we'll have justice. He says, I have a dream. And so I think that that speech reminds me of this dream of bodhisattvas. And I think, and I say this sometimes, you know, that this is a dream that we have as human beings. Why would anybody think that this dream is worth having, since we've never seen anything like it ever happen? This dream that there could be justice, that there could be peace, that people could love one another. Where does a dream like that come from? Because when did you ever see that, you know, in the world? But that's part of what we are, don't you think? It's like part of being human. And that's what these bodhisattvas are expressing. That's what Dr. King expressed. And I think that we all have that dream. And that's what keeps us going. Without that dream, I mean, think about it. Think about humanity, right? Totally absent that dream. I mean, we see what it looks like around the world, you know? Like this horrible war that's going on in Sudan, you know, where arguably more people are being killed than anywhere else. There's nothing at stake in that war. And there's no, this is my territory. There's just like one band of robbers fighting another band of robbers, and everybody's caught in the middle. That's what it's like when there's no dream like this. There's just grabbing and power and violence. And you wonder, like, is it worth being human? We need this dream that the bodhisattvas in this sutra are expressing. So after these 10 metaphors are finished, many of the enlightened beings, one after the other, stand up and recite poems, offering poems to the Buddha. And I'll give you one example on page 31. These are shortish poems, but there's lots of them. Here's one of them. Each one given by a different enlightening being with a different name. So then the enlightening being named Standard of Knowledge, Scattering All Bands of Demons, that's her name, by the power of the Buddha, because everything but the bodhisattvas do is powered by the Buddha, looked over the 10 directions and spoke the following verses. Being the body of unobstructed knowledge, the independence is incorporeal. In the realm of inconceivable knowledge that cannot be conceived, the Buddha body is realized by inconceivable pure deeds. Undefiled by the triple world, it shines with distinctive embellishments. Universal light of the world, having clarified the reality realm, it is also the door of enlightenment, the mine of all knowledge. Dispassionate, free from falsehood, having shed all hindrances, as the sun of the world, Buddha radiates lights of knowledge. That which removes the fears of existence and purifies those in the triple world, the development of enlightening beings is thus the mine of Buddha's enlightenment. Buddha shows infinite forms without sticking to any form, and shows those inconceivable forms through all living creatures, all living creatures. No one can reach the end of the knowledge of Buddha, by which inconceivable enlightenment is instantly clarified. Inexhaustible exposition of knowledge, wherein are the Buddhas of all times, is produced in a single instant without any change in essence. The wise seeker of enlightenment engaged in endless action should always think. Although it be thought, no thought is born in this thought. That's think not thinking, right? Doesn't that sound like think not thinking? The inconceivable elements of Buddhahood realized by the perfectly enlightened are profound beyond all telling, beyond the scope of words. Then, after everybody's poem is done, because all of this is like a ritual, right, to you know, prepare the ground for the teaching, after all this is done, the Samantabhadra, universally good, now explains the lion's roar concentration. This is all about the lion's roar concentration. He explains it in 10 aspects. So let's see. Of course, 10 aspects, right? So here we go. I'll read you a part of this. This is on page 35. This is universally good. Then the great enlightening being, universally good, having looked over the host of enlightening beings everywhere to further analyze, discuss in detail, explain, reveal, elucidate, bring to light, illumine, and point out by means of the cosmos of truths, equal to the realm of space, equal to past, present, and future, equal to the realm of realities, equal to the realm of beings, equal to the realm of all worlds, equal to all sets of actions, equal to the dispositions of beings, equal to the interests of beings, equal to the specific illustrations of truth, equal to the appropriate times for the manifestation of beings, and equal to the faculties of all Buddhas. Finally, we get to the verb of the sentence. That was all just like a little bit of a clause between the subject and the verb. Elucidated. This lion emergence concentration of Buddha by means of 10 indications. Indication of number one, the succession of all Buddhas and the succession of lands and the atoms of Buddha lands throughout all universes. Indication of number two, the seeking and following the virtues of the Buddhas and all the Buddha lands in space throughout the future. Indication of number three, Buddhas emerging in all Buddha lands and showing the ocean of infinitely various doors of enlightenment. And indication of four, the hosts of enlightening beings in the circles of the Buddhas in the Buddha lands throughout space, facing the terrace of enlightenment. That means just at the moment of enlightenment. Let's see, blah, 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 blah. The five, indication of pervading the cosmos in a moment of thought with emanations in the forms of the Buddhas of past, present, and future, emitted from every pore. Indication of number six, the light of magical pervasion of all multitudes of lands in all oceans in all directions equally with one body. Indication of number seven, revelation of the power of concentration of all pasts, presents, and futures, of the transfigurations of the state of Buddhahood in the surfaces of all objects. What? On the surfaces of all the objects. So don't think it's about depth. It's just as superficial as anything else. Objects, indications of number 10, number eight, manifestation of the oceans of eons of various successive transfigurations of Buddha in the lands of past, present, and future, equal to the atoms in all lands. Indication of number nine, the birth of enlightening beings from the endless power emanating from every pore by the ocean of vows of all Buddhas of past, present, and future. And indication of endless number 10, manifestations of varied expositions of truth amid equal adornments of sites of enlightenment, with circles of enlightening beings around lion thrones, equal in the extent to the cosmos. These 10, O offspring of the victor is the Buddha, children of the Buddha, these 10 things said Samantabhadra, universally good, enlightening being, are the first 10. of as many expressions of the lion emergence concentration as atoms in untold Buddha lands, which I follow. However, these are the spheres of knowledge of those who arrive at thusness. Now, that sets the stage for the Buddha to come on the scene, and the Buddha comes on the scene finally. All of this is the preliminary stuff that has to happen before the Buddha is going to begin teaching. So now we're on page 37, and the Buddha is going to start here. So I'll read you a little bit more on this page, because let's see. Yeah, because it has something that I was very excited to read in this passage. Then the blessed Buddha, wanting to establish those enlightening beings in this lion emergence concentration of Buddhas, did what he always does in these cases. He emanates from the circle of hair between his brows a light. He doesn't explain stuff, the Buddha. He sends out lights. And this light is called, it has a name, it's a special one called illumining past, present, and future, showing all the ways into the reality realm. And it was accompanied by as many beams of light as atoms in untold Buddha lands, with which he illuminated all lands and all oceans and worlds in the 10 directions. Then the enlightening beings who had gathered at the Jada Grove saw in every Buddha land, in all universes, throughout the farthest reaches of space, in groups of Buddha lands, within atoms of Buddha lands, as numerous as atoms in all Buddha lands. So in every Buddha land, there are all these atoms, and on every atom, there's a whole Buddha land. You know, so there's a lot of Buddha lands all over the place. You can't even imagine. In Buddha lands of various powers, blah, 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 blah. They're all doing this and that in these various places. I'm skipping. And as these enlightening beings saw the transfigurations of the profound concentration of the Buddha in all those assemblies, they saw transfigurations of Buddha throughout the cosmos. So I got interested in, what is a transfiguration? You know, have you ever known that word? You know, I don't know what word Cleary is translating, but the transfiguration, I think it's in Christianity, right? In fact, on August 6th is the church festival called the Transfiguration. And the transfiguration is when ordinary stuff that you look at, and that seems to be ordinary stuff, suddenly becomes, it's still the same, but it becomes transfigured, it becomes other. So I think it's more or less the equivalent of suchness. I think it's kind of like suchness in Buddhism, transfiguration. And maybe even that's the word he's translating, I don't know. But the whole world of all these Buddhas becomes transfigured in this way. Blah, blah, blah.
Transfigured
blah,
blah. Into what?
Well, it says he saw it just transfigured into itself only more so, into itself only the suchness of it, I think. I'll read you the first couple of sentences. And as these enlightening beings saw the transfigurations of the profound concentration of the Buddha in all these assemblies, they saw transfigurations of Buddha throughout the cosmos, in all worlds, throughout space, in the arrays of the 10 directions, in the sets of cycles, in all places, in the confluence of all spaces, in the media of principle. So this is telling you where these transfigurations occur, and they pretty much occur everywhere. But this is the part that caught my eye, and I was talking to some folks yesterday about this. All of them were united. Now, this is on page 38 in the top. All of them were united by the blessed Vairochana Buddha, who now appears for the first time, I think. Now, there's a conflation, as we said the other day, in the sutra between Shakyamuni Buddha and Vairochana Buddha. Vairochana Buddha is sort of the cosmic Buddha. The Buddha beyond Buddhas, the Buddha, the all-inclusive Buddha. So all of them were united by the blessed Vairochana Buddha by the four integrative methods, by equality of past virtuous actions. They were fully developed by seeing, hearing, and remembering. They had already set their minds on supreme enlightenment. Going to the Buddhas here and there, they were united by fundamental virtues in accord with the sameness of their roots of goodness and adoption of means of developing omniscience. The enlightening beings gained access to the projections of the concentrations of the blessed Vairochana, which extended throughout the cosmos to the farthest reaches of space. So there are, there's a system in of cosmic Buddhas. There are five cosmic Buddhas. Vairochana is sort of the central cosmic Buddha. But the thing that astonished me and caught my eye was, you might not have noticed this, but the four integrative methods. And those are my favorite teaching of Dogen. Those are the greatest thing of the, if anybody, if you want to, you know, read Dogen, the only thing you need to read is this one fascicle, which is called, in Kaz's translation, the four Bodhisattvas, four methods of guidance. And here they call them the four integrative methods. And I always thought Dogen made them up, but no, they're in Mahayana sutras, and I didn't remember that they're actually mentioned a number of times in this sutra. Those the four methods are very special for bodhisattvas, because the whole thing about bodhisattvas is practicing with other people and for other people, inspired by other people and inspiring other people. But you cannot, you've noticed this, you can't talk people into stuff, right? It doesn't work out. It also doesn't work out to like go to a foreign land, subjugate the people and tell them, you have to believe in this for your own salvation and it'll be good for you. That doesn't work out either, it's been tried. No, that will not work. The only way that bodhisattvas can do it is by their spontaneous example, not by manipulating or convincing or tricking, but by conducting themselves beautifully. That's the way. So just in other words, you do that for yourself, and you do that knowing that that's the only way you can help anybody. So the four integrative methods, which are beautifully discussed in Dogen, and I've talked about them so many times, are giving, generosity, fundamental generosity, generosity of your presence, but also every kind of generosity you can think of. Generosity, kind speech, never a cruel word, never a thoughtless word. Kind speech. In there, Dogen says, speak to sentient beings as you would speak to a baby, with that kind of kindness. Kind speech, beneficial action, and what he calls, Kaz translates as identity action, meaning action that expresses your solidarity and identity with other beings. So in other words, helping people is a bad idea, because if you help somebody, they need help. You don't. You're helping them. But bodhisattvas don't help anybody. They are always in identity with everybody. So there's no helping. There's always identity. So, but they do stuff for people, beneficial action, but they do it in the spirit of identity action. Anyway, there's a whole teaching. The whole fascicle is only a few pages long, but it's really wonderful. You could read it again and again and again. And I really think it's the only thing you need to do in practice. You don't even need to do zazen, you know, just do that. And practice that, and that's it. You know? Yeah.
Kind speech, beneficial action.
Identity action. That's how Kaz translates it. And we were, Kathy and I were in the Dogen seminar at Upaya a week before this last weekend, and we were talking about this one because it's our favorite. So anyway, I didn't. I never knew it was mentioned. I was really impressed to see it there. Yeah. It doesn't list them. It just says the four integrative methods.
Okay.
But they're in Dogen. Dogen, listen. The fascicle is called Bodhisatta Shisho Ho. Shishobo, yeah, thank you. Bodhisattva Shishobo. Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance. It's a wonderful teaching of Dogen. I really recommend it. So then the projections of the concentrations of Vairochana Buddha are explained in many, 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 many pages. And hearing about them, all the enlightening beings are overcome with compassion and the overwhelming desire to be of benefit to beings. And so they immediately rush off and start practicing the 10 paramitas. And they appear in the world in a million different ways to be of benefit to as many kinds of beings as exist anywhere. Now remember, so now we're on about page 45 or so, we're about 40 pages into the sutra. Remember that this sutra is the pilgrimage of Sudana, who goes to visit 59 teachers. So far, Sudana has not yet appeared, right? After all this is going on, this is all just a preparation for getting around to Sudana. He hasn't appeared yet. I'll just end with a little bit of the Bodhisattva's who want to help beings. This is reading on page 45. The enlightening beings in the Jada Grove were seen by various arrays of projections pervading all realms of beings in all oceans of worlds, yet without leaving the presence of the Buddha. Some appeared pervading the 10 directions, their bodies on their thrones, in their towers, surrounded by their associates, yet without becoming absent from the presence of the Buddha. Some appeared emanating clouds of apparitions to developed beings, yet without being absent from the assembly around the Buddha. Some appeared in the form of beggars, the homeless person on the street, probably is one of these bodhisattvas, you know, probably is. Some in the form of priests, even priests could be bodhisattvas. Some in bodies adorned head to foot with particular and emblematic signs. I guess it means the tattooed guy, I guess. Some in the form of scholars, scientists, doctors, epidemiologists maybe. Some in the form of merchants. Some in the form of ascetics. Some in the form of entertainers, comedians, dancers, singers. Some in the form of pietists. Some in the form of bearers of all kinds of arts and crafts. They were seen to have come in their various forms to all villages, cities, towns, communities, districts, and nations. Yeah, so they don't just appear in this exalted form. They appear in whatever form is needed to take care of beings. And taking care of beings seems to include pretty much everything. So all our ideas about what it is to take care of beings, they're very limited, right? Taking care of beings is everything. The whole world actually is there to take care of beings, everything that you do. So you can actually do any kind of activity if you do it with a spirit of offering it to sentient beings for their benefit. Whatever activity you're doing, assuming it's not violent or harmful, is a beneficial activity. So all arts and crafts and kind words and programs of any sort.
Wow.
Okay. So, I'm stopping there and for 2 weeks, because next week I won't be here. I'm running off yet again. I do nothing but take vacations. I think the vacations are harder than regular working. At least my work. Vacations are much more difficult. So we're taking a vacation, short one, to go to Denver to meet our kids who are going on a big backpacking trip. We're not going on that backpacking trip, but we're going to meet them for a few days of hiking suitable for the elderly, after which they're going to go on a big backpacking trip. So we'll be gone from Tuesday, be back on Saturday. And so John is, I thank John for taking care of the sutra of the seminar next week. And I'll remind you again that I'll be on at Spirit Rock on Saturday to do a day long on continuous practice. Remember those talks I did sometime in the past on continuous practice, which has been accepted, the manuscript has been accepted by Shambhala. So now we're getting ready to, it'll be whenever they're ready to put it out, it'll be coming up. So I think we have time for groups. Usually in our groups, we talk about how does the teaching that we're thinking about, whatever it may be, give you a way to practice? But I'm not sure that that kind of a question applies in this situation. The teaching of the Gandavyuha seems way beyond that. So maybe our question is more like, and I think if we take a minute before we talk, a minute or two, oh, look, there's Tim and Dawu, both of them are there. Hi, guys. their baby is safely cared for by others, I guess. And maybe our question is, how is this striking you so far? How is this striking your heart so far? Mm-hmm. Not your mind, whether you think it makes sense or not, but is it going into your heart in some way? Or maybe it's hardening your heart because maybe it puts you off. We said at the beginning that I recognize, fully recognize, that this sutra is not necessarily everybody's cup of tea, these kinds of sutras. So in the groups, let's be honest. And if you're not yet used to this, or if you think you not only are you not used to it, but you don't want to get used to it, then you should say so, and because we're all friends here, and honesty is the only thing that really counts. So let's get in our groups, and before we talk, we'll just take, I'll ring a bell for a moment of sitting. So the same online, everybody will get in groups, and maybe in your groups, you can all, when you're all settled, just breathe together for maybe time it by the watch, 2 minutes, and then start speaking. And this time it'll be a short take, 3 minutes each person without a follow-up, just three, three, and three, and then we'll close the groups after about 10 minutes. Okay? So bye-bye, everybody online. Nice to see all of you. We'll see you again in 10 minutes.